Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hey everyone, Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us this week for our conversation with John Reynolds. John is a senior executive, has led organizations for a number of years, and most recently was senior vice president at United Health Group and was general manager, CEO of their Optum Connect group. He has also led organizations such as FIS, a publicly traded company. And earlier in his career, he was in the banking industry, was a senior vice president with Wells Fargo. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Minnesota in economics and went on to get a PhD in organizational development and management. He is an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota and teaches on the subject of leadership. Looking forward to our conversation with John today. Well, first off, can you give us just a little bit of a background overview of your career?
Well, I'd be happy to. It spans the better part of 30 years, and so it's I'll try to do my best to keep the story brief.
Sure.
Started out for me, I got a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Minnesota, and maybe like a lot of young people, you know, coming out of that experience, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had been working while I was in school. I was working as a ward clerk on a pediatric intensive care ward. Wow. And I was making some money. And what I did was I invested that money in flying lessons. Okay. So I had a passion for learning how to fly, and I did that. I picked up my private license, my commercial license. I became a flight instructor, multi-engine rating, instrument rating, and whatnot, and actually began to teach flying at the University of Minnesota while I was finishing up my bachelor's degree. And I continued forward with that. That's really what I thought I wanted to do at that stage of my life. And I started to fly for a company in Minneapolis. I would fly their sales representatives out and around the region. I continued to flight instruct, and then I got a job as an air freight pilot. And that job was, you know, basically I would take off at 11 p.m., wheels up, and I absolutely positively had to be wheels down 7 a.m. The next morning. Wow. In order that they could load the planes and sure. Have the planes fly off to their next destination and get the mail or whatever the items were that we were moving to where they were supposed to go. But it was actually during one of those flights where I had this aha moment. 2 o'clock in the morning, Minot, North Dakota, middle of January, 30 degrees below zero, and was, you know, loading the plane on my way to my next stop, which was going to be Bismarck. The loadmaster came out to the plane, and I dutifully hopped out, and I had my Air Force flight suit on, which is the only thing you could wear that would possibly keep you warm enough. And I was double-checking the math with with the load, because weight and balance is critical when you're flying air freight. And it dawned on me that it wasn't really the sharpest knife in the drawer that was out helping load the plane and do those calculations. It was really cold. I wasn't really finding that flying was giving me quite the enjoyment that I had hoped it would. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to grad school and I'm going to start myself down a different career. And that's really what I did. From that point on, I was fortunate. I was able to get a job working for a company that was in the Silicon Valley. This is the mid-80s, that was doing some really exciting and fun things. And, you know, I had never really been exposed to a business environment, anything at all like that, software developers, hardware technicians, you know, all of that in this, you know, raw, fast-moving California environment. We had sand volleyball courts outside of the lunchroom. I'd never seen anything like that. I didn't know business could be like that. And so I really got the bug and had really just a wonderful introduction to the business world there. And I also got some great training about selling, about marketing, about technology. We really had to learn how to do everything in that role. Everything from putting a computer together to training people how to use the software. And it was probably one of the better experiences that I had from a learning perspective, because my job was basically to go out and sell these computers to junkyards and auto parts dealers. So it was a great business experience, because it honestly, you know, over the course of my career, even though I have worked for some of the largest companies in the country with some very, very sophisticated leadership and some great business leaders, I have to say that some of the best business people I've ever met were the folks who were running those junkyards and those auto parts stores. I mean, they were really close to their customers, and they were having to make on the spot business decisions. And it was, you know, very, very important foundational learning experience for me. Great. From there, I did go to grad school. I picked up a master's degree because I felt I needed that. I needed to expand my tool set in the business arena. I also was fortunate, and I was able to grab on to a couple of mentors. And I would, of course, encourage young people who are just getting started in their careers to be very thoughtful about that as a part of their learning and development experience. But through that networking and through that mentoring experience, it's really what led me to work for Norwest. And Norwest Bank eventually became Wells Fargo. And honestly, I would have never thought in my wildest imagination that I would go work for a bank. But it so happened that Norwest at that time was forming a new business unit that was focused on bank franchising. And so the effort there was really to assemble a group of people who came from varied disciplines. So, you know, my colleagues were, you know, out of a waste management company because, you know, Browning Ferris actually was the name of the firm, well-known waste management firm. And the reason that that person was important was that they had a lot of experience with acquisitions.
Sure.
And acquisitions was definitely a theme behind the whole franchising idea. The other senior folks also had come out of disciplines like NCR and IBM and were involved in all aspects of consulting. So we had a number of consultants who were part of that team. And the idea was to really go out and help banks stay competitive in their communities by leveraging the full range of capabilities that we could bring to the table. And so that was a really foundational, interesting learning experience for me as well. And it's how I got into the banking business. Mm-hmm. Same thing in my next move to Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh. I never would have thought that Pittsburgh would be on the agenda, but it was also a wonderful learning opportunity for me. And I was able to follow along with one of these people who was a mentor to me while I was at Norwest. It was a very senior level person who was, you know, very adept at turnarounds. And Mellon Bank at that time, this is the late 80s, was in the midst of a significant turnaround. They had gotten into trouble with LDC debt in South America. And so they were in the throes of, you know, a very, very significant set of changes, tough changes that they were going to have to go through. And I was fortunate enough to be a part of that from a management perspective. In fact, had the opportunity to work with McKinsey, who had been retained to help the bank effectively refocus its strategy into vertical markets where they had unique strengths and capabilities that they had developed over the years. It was one of those experiences that I really have come to appreciate, because I was different also, I think, than most of my colleagues who were there. It was a time where, you know, the bank was largely, you know, made up of folks that represented what the prior leadership had been like, which was, you know, there were a lot of the senior leaders were from Ivy League schools, and most of my colleagues had gone to Ivy League schools, and I showed up and I had gone to a state university in Minnesota. And so that in and of itself was always a point of, you know, discussion in and of itself. But the differentiating thing for me was I could sell. I knew how to sell. I knew how to solve business issues that they had and deal with the kinds of problems that they had, especially at that time where they were going through this significant turnaround. So that was an important learning experience for me. From there, I got hired back to Wells Fargo. I was recruited back into a role at Norwest at the time. And my role was effectively to consolidate a number of businesses that were otherwise decentralized through their network of banks. And that's really what started me into also the healthcare business. So I had done the work, the hard work of consolidating those businesses and positioned Wells Fargo or Norwest at the time to be a player in the institutional trust and custody business. And then through that effort, I was also exposed to sort of an emerging trend that we saw, which was that a lot of our clients would benefit from having consulting services as well. So what could we do to extend our offering that would be also inclusive of consulting services to help, you know, with the design of the benefit plans that they were offering to their employees? And so I was able to be a part of the acquisition of a consulting firm that we folded into Wells Fargo, and it became then actually a part of the businesses that I was leading. And through the data that we were gathering through that consulting firm, we saw evidence of a major shift occurring in the area of health benefits. And so, you know, the actuarial consulting firm that we acquired had been very actively engaged in helping mid-sized employers solve for the problems, not only of retirement-related risk and growth, but also the risk associated with health benefits. They were largely, most of these firms were self-insured. And so this is where, you know, the actuarial consulting practice that we had came into focus. And we saw at the same time legislation that was evolving that was going to eventually lead to the creation of health savings accounts. And so I saw that as an opportunity to get the firm into that space as well. And we were able to, through another acquisition, we were able to pick up an operation in Salt Lake City that we then used to create what became known as Wells Fargo Health Benefit Services, headquartered in Salt Lake City. So that was really a very foundational, interesting learning experience for me as well, for a host of different reasons related to business strategy development and execution, because it entailed setting something brand new up inside of a highly siloed organization and driving growth into a brand new emerging market, which frankly doesn't happen that often in the banking business, where you have new, something that's totally new. From there, I was recruited away to go to work for a company called Metavante, which was a subsidiary of Marshall and Ilsley Bank in Milwaukee. And the design there was that they wanted to spin off Marshall and Ilsley's data processing business, which was Metavante. And so I joined in 2006. They spun off Metavante in 2007 and created a separate publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange that was helped largely by an investment that Warburg Pincus made to the tune of $500 million in that venture. And Metavante then became a separate publicly traded company. There I ran the healthcare business, the government business, and also what we call the biller direct business, which was really a billing services company. And our clients were big public utility companies and firms that had a lot of direct-to-consumer billing functions that they would hire us for. That was just a wonderful learning experience as well. A lot of M&A activity there, a lot of integration work in bringing together all of these different companies and assets and things like that and creating a really coherent go-to-market strategy. Interestingly enough, 2 years after we went public, our firm was acquired by FIS. And FIS is sometimes known as Fidelity National Information Services. It's now the world's largest fintech company. Really a an interesting firm that has a very important collection of assets that, if you really thought about it, is touching a lot of consumers across the board because they have a very deep penetration into the financial services industry globally. Right. They own assets like SunGard that many people would recognize. And they're also behind the scenes in a lot of things, whether it's driving ATMs or processing merchant transactions or credit card transactions and things like that. But what happened to my business was that after the acquisition, it became pretty clear that healthcare and government weren't necessarily going to be a key component to their strategy. And so it became pretty clear that I was heading down a path where I was either going to have to advance an idea of heavy investment to achieve the objective of number one or number two market share, or, you know, the alternative was to divest these assets at a multiple. Frankly, at that time, the healthcare assets were trading at a multiple significantly higher than what the parent company was at. And so I knew that's where I was heading. Eventually was able to get them to move toward a divestiture track, and the assets were divested in 2012. From there, you know, I went and thought that I would start my own firm, which I did, and then partnered with another firm. And I will tell you, a learning lesson there was take your time. Take your time. Take a pause after a big change and sure. Think carefully about what that next move is. But that's what led me into creating and being a part of then a relatively small private company with we had 75 employees or thereabouts. Did that for a couple of years, kind of ran out what I would argue to be a strategy that was catering to the emerging market of defined contribution health and private exchanges. And ultimately, I think that it's still a market that's emerging. And I felt it was going to take a little bit too long to get there. And so I left that and joined Optum, which was a part of United Health Group. And so here I am now, several years later, but that's at least a quick flyover, as quick sure. a flyover as I can give you about my sure. Professional background.
Tell me a little bit, if you were to go back, and we've asked this question of other executives, if you were to go back with what you know now and your life experience, what advice would you give a John Reynolds if you were, you know, a 22-year-old today? What would you tell him?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of key lessons that I can think of that would extend way beyond a 30-minute podcast, but I would say there are a couple of things. You know, while it's important in a leadership role to develop a compelling strategy, for example, that's engaging to employees and things like that, I think along the way, it's really important to also say no and learn how to say no to things. I mean, there are a lot of really great ideas. And I think, you know, one of the key competencies to have is to know what to say no to. And so I would argue that saying no is something that's really, really important. The other thing is you have to be careful about falling in love with ideas. There are many examples that I could point to in my career where I, you know, especially in the area of acquisitions, because you're being sold by firms that are very adept at selling. And, you know, some of the ideas are really compelling, but you have to step back and think logically about, you know, really, really what is the possibility of actually integrating that capability into your broader offering. And you have to remember at the end of the day, no matter how you want to spin all of this, that you have to stay execution focused. And so that would be my other key lesson. I think no matter what, with the firms that I've worked with, whether a large privately held firm or a really large corporation like United Health Group or Wells Fargo or FIS, at the end of the day, you're paid to execute. And mm-hmm. so that has to stay top of mind. And I think as a part of that, as a leader, you still have to inspect what you expect. So you can set these visions out there, you can put together these very creative strategic plans, but you really have to continue to inspect and make sure that you're actually executing on the plan that you've put out there. And I think what goes hand in glove with that is, you know, you have to foster a culture of accountability amongst the leadership team. So those are a couple of things. And then I think one that's obvious, and you've probably heard this from many, many of your folks that you've talked to in your podcast, but you really have to hire well. I think hiring is you know, a key element to all of it. You've got to have the right people on your team. And this is where I would say, you know, hiring Seema or hiring somebody like yourself, Mark, to help in that process is critical. But I think part of it is you have to think about describing the role, about what you're expecting this person to be doing on your team, and be very honest about that. Use a third party in order to sort of help you assess whether or not the person actually fits against what your expectations are for that role. I would also argue you have to hire diversity. And I'm not just saying that because that's the thing to say these days. Right. I really believe it. And when I say diversity, I think about, sure, it's gender, it's ethnic diversity, but it's also age, and it's also people who come from different disciplines, because it helps to give you better perspective about the types of business problems that you're solving for. So I think those would be the key lessons. And then the final one would be keep networking. Networking is just so important. It's important to have mentors, and it's important to have connections that extend across and around, you know, various other disciplines.
That's good. Any, as you talk about the importance of hiring, as maybe some of the people that are listening are hiring their first executive team. You mentioned as far as having diversity as being a part of it, so different viewpoints. Anything else that you would add to that as far as things to think about as you're hiring some new executives?
Well, I have always said, hire people that are smarter than you. And for me, that wasn't hard. But, you know, hiring people who are really capable and are ambitious, but being mindful that it's important not to hire people who are all the same. And what I mean by that extends beyond just the issues of, you know, gender and ethnic diversity, but it's really, you know, don't hire people who are all type A's. Right. That's probably not a good strategy. I've been a part of organizations like that. Many of us probably can relate to that, especially in some of the larger companies where everyone kind of is the same personality type. Not a good indicator for success, in my opinion. So,
great. So you've taught some 20-somethings at the University of Minnesota and have done that. Tell us a little bit about your experience there, and maybe, you know, I always say the best way to learn something is to teach it. You learn through the process, but talk to us a little bit about some of the key lessons that that you've taught.
Well, it's been a lot of fun for me to teach. It's called The Dynamics of Leadership is the course itself, and it extends through an entire semester, and it is a blast. It's the kind of thing that I encourage people who've got a lot of experience to go out and do, because in the academic environment, it's just so important to have people who can relate, you know, real life experiences to the learning process. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of the semester, we cover off on all of the normal things that you would expect. We talk a lot about values, and we talk about diversity and ethics and things like that. But I would say for me, there are two things in particular that I put the most attention to that are foundational. And that is, number one, it's self-awareness. So we can all relate to this. I really feel like if you talk to most people who've worked inside of human organizations, whether for-profit, not-for-profit, private, public, whatever, we've worked with people who didn't have good self-awareness. They didn't have that 360-degree perspective. And so I put a lot of emphasis on that. And we use different tools to help the students sort of, you know, gather some perspective on what their strengths are. You know, I find great optimism in working with these students because they are really smart. I mean, they are. I mean, I have been blown away by the talent that we're getting through the program, and it gives me great optimism about what our future is going to be like in the healthcare marketplace with these types of people entering into the leadership space. But what we try to put emphasis on from a teaching perspective is it's important to know what your strengths are, but it's more important almost to know what your weaknesses are so that you can fill them in. You don't have to be all things to all people. Right. You just need to really know maybe the things that you're not as good at so that you can fill in with other folks who can round you out. The thing that we also try to impress upon them is, you know, you gotta be smart. You have to be good business people. But you also have to have high EQ. So right. That yep. Emotional intelligence is really, really important when you're leading people. And so it's this balance that we're trying to impart upon these students that is so critical to their future growth. And so self-awareness is really important. We put a lot of attention to that. And then in the group exercises that we have the students run through, it gives them an opportunity to practice and try different styles and techniques in a really safe environment, right? In these group exercises. The second thing that we put a lot of emphasis on is critical thinking. And, you know, everybody thinks, we all think, but you know, when I say critical thinking, what I mean by that is using information and information generating beliefs. So we all have certain beliefs and things that we bring into the workplace and business problem solving. What we're trying to do is to get the students to process information, to think about their beliefs, and develop those skills to bring those parts and pieces together. Mm-hmm. You know, and at a very simple level, you know, we want the students to really substantiate their thinking by looking broadly. So it's not just an opinion, but it's an informed opinion about the decisions that they're looking to make. And then to really develop some habits around that so that, you know, at a very basic level, it's having them think widely, continue to focus on learning so that they are, you know, developing, a set of data and perspectives that they can bring into their decision process. So those are the two things that we really try to use as foundational elements to the class.
Yeah, as we had talked earlier, and being a pilot, tell us a little, just your thoughts around taking your flying experience as a pilot. You have to have critical thinking as a pilot, but maybe relate that to business and just some of the lessons you've learned as a pilot and relate it to business.
Well, there are a lot of lessons that I can think of related to that. You know, I think one that I talk about is you got to have a plan. Obviously, when you're flying a plane, whether it's with passengers or freight or for whatever reason, you have to have a plan on where you're going. And one of the things that we did as flight instructors is we put a lot of emphasis on planning for the things that go wrong. So, you know, that's if you've ever learned how to fly or you're learning to fly or you think about the learning process there, most of the training really centers on situations that go wrong. Mm-hmm. How to recover from a stall, what to do when your engine goes out, how to fly in the clouds and keep your proper attitude. But I would say the analogy that I use the most when I'm talking into business people about my flying experiences, I talk about the importance of staying ahead of the airplane. Because as you fly faster and faster airplanes, you have to make decisions faster. And you have less time to recover if you make a mistake. And so, you know, it's a great analogy to things that happen in business, because right. If you don't stay ahead, if you're not keeping an eye on the competition, if you're not listening to your customers, if you're not reacting, you can get into trouble fast. And especially, you know, that analogy comes true when you're flying a plane. I mean, fatal crashes oftentimes are a result of, you know, the pilot getting behind the airplane. Things just happening faster than they can accommodate recovery. We talk a lot in the flying business about, you know, this cascade of things that happens. When something goes bad, it's not usually just one thing. It's like one thing that sets off, you know, two or three other bad things that happen. And so, you know, it's just the multiplier effect of bad things. And there are a lot of analogies in business that are exactly like that. So staying ahead of the airplane is one of my favorite analogies to flying.
Great. Any books that you've read that have made an impact on you, anything that you're currently reading or read in the past that you think would be valuable for those listening?
So I've got a stack of books that I have sitting on my night table. I haven't read a lot over the last semester because I've been so enthralled with reading all of the papers, sure, and things like that the students have been throwing my way. But there are two books that have been impactful to me over the last couple of years and that have really related, I think, very closely to the types of business issues that I've had to solve for. So one of them is Team of Teams by Stanley McChrystal. And in this book, he's really talking about his role when he took command of the Special Operations Task Force back in 2003, when they were trying to effectively get the various armed services divisions, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, everybody to work together and collaborate in order that they could defeat a much more agile adversary in the form of Al-Qaeda. And if you think about work inside of really large organizations that has siloed, you know, really hardened silos that are around various entities inside of the organization, there are a lot of parallels there. So I really liked the book. It resonated with me. It also enabled me to come away with things that I could use from a leadership and management perspective around the idea of, you know, ensuring that there's a common purpose, that everybody understands why we're doing what we're doing, that there is, you know, an understanding also of why trust is important, and that you're developing some type of a shared consciousness. And that's another key thing as far as cross-team communication is concerned and whatnot. Look, we have great tools now from a technology perspective that help to enable communication. We just need to make better use of them. And so that was a key learning. And then the one that I think a lot of large organizations struggle with, and it was is a great example in his book about the military having, you know, this 100 years or more history of, you know, very hierarchical structure. But really, in order to meet the challenge, they had to rethink the way that they made decisions, and they needed to be more empowered really at the line. And so, you know, getting to that and increasing, you know, engagement of their leaders that are really close to the line. So that was a great book. I think it's good for people who work inside of large organizations who are trying to engender some type of change, you know, across the board that involves, you know, working together, collaborating to solve for really complex customer issues. The second book is, you know, Start With Why. Again, widely read book in the business community. I really liked it. It made sense to me as a person who has really advanced new ideas inside of organizations and created new things as an entrepreneur inside of these big organizations where you have to be an evangelist, if you will. But getting to an understanding about why are we doing this, and really making it clear, you know, to all of the stakeholders. I think there's some great lessons in here. I found that book to be really helpful and an effective, you know, reminder to a lot of us about the reasons that we're doing what we're doing. So that's another favorite.
Good. Any parting advice that you would give those that are either moving into a new leadership role or starting out in their career?
Well, you know, aside from the things that I've mentioned already, I would say, you know, one of the things that clearly is the hardest thing that you do as a leader and a manager is really dealing with conflict. And so conflict is something we talk a fair amount about that in the leadership class, but you just have to accept the inevitability that you're going to have conflict, especially sure. You're pushing new ideas and doing new things. You're going to have conflict. Don't ruminate about it. Don't avoid it. Stay calm, maintain the high ground, so to speak. Don't pull rank. I mean, that's another key lesson that I've learned, you know, and partner with human capital if need be, but basically don't think in terms of winning. Just focus on, you know, constructively resolving the conflict. The conflict resolution is a key thing that leaders and managers, you just have to be prepared to deal with that. It's an ongoing thing. And if you do it well, you're going to be really successful.
Right. Great. Well, thanks, John. Definitely appreciate your time and your insights today. Yeah, it was definitely a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.